So welcome to the next installment of the Midler's podcast. We've got a great guest this evening. We're excited to introduce to you. This is Bill. And Yusuf, you're there?
Yes. Hi, Bill.
Hey. And hey, we're going to introduce to you this evening Linda Floyd. Linda is based in Seattle. And Linda is someone with whom I've got a personal friendship. And when Tara and I were living over in India, we came to know Linda and her family quite well. And she's actually got some interesting things going on with India on a sustained basis. So, Linda, welcome to the Midler's podcast.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So, Linda, tell us a little bit about how, as an American based in Seattle, and actually a Canadian by birth, if I'm not mistaken, you came to be involved in India as a country.
Well, I lived in Dubai for 6 years in the 1990s, and during that time, I worked with a lot of people from India. There were especially a lot of people from the west coast of India in Dubai, and I used to work with them, and I hung out with them, and in fact, I often spent Christmas with the Goan community that was in Dubai. And when I ended up moving back to Canada, I wanted to maintain that connection with that part of the world, and it worked in a very fortunate way that I happened to meet the man who became my husband, who was American, but his family is originally from India, and they're Goan. So I met Dave, and we ultimately got married, and of course, that really gave me a much stronger connection to the Goan culture and India in general. And after we'd been married for some time and we'd had kids, we decided to take the opportunity to move overseas if we could with his company. And we got the offer to move to Hyderabad for 2 years. And we thought, great, let's show our kids India and let's experience living in India together as a family. So we moved to Hyderabad in 2007 and were there for 2 years and had a great time.
Linda, that is fascinating, your connection and how you slowly gravitated toward India. And how did you experience India for the first time actually being there? What were some of the stark differences in terms of your upbringing, the way you viewed the world, and then the people versus the people who you started interacting with in India?
Well, it's funny. My family is actually Scandinavian Canadian. My mother's from Denmark. And one of the things I think I thought first of all when we were first in India was, I don't think you could get two countries more different than Denmark and India. India is just so populated, first of all, just the people everywhere all the time. That was a big adjustment for me, I think, when we first moved there. I had visited India before and, of course, knew a lot about the country, I thought. But just having people around all the time, wherever you are, there's always someone near. Even in your home when you're living there, there's people coming in and out all the time. That was a very, very big adjustment for me. And I don't think I ever really felt entirely comfortable with that. That was challenging. But what I really loved was just how warm and friendly people were, hospitable. I loved that whole part of the culture. People were always welcoming. I never felt like I was a foreigner and in the wrong place. People were always very open, I would say.
Yeah, some of the in terms of interacting with different cultures and intercultural communication, what some of the things that really stand out is a collectivist versus individualist societies, fluid sense of time versus a very regimented sense of time, and then direct versus indirect communication. Were any of those barriers f- for you, or was there any learning there for you initially based on those aspects of intercultural communication?
Certainly the aspect of time was very different and more fluid, less rigid. And that was definitely challenging for me, and not just for me, I think for my husband as well. My husband has, grew up most of his life in the U.S., and certainly his work culture was very American. And so that was a big adjustment to deal with things not starting on time or people arriving late or all of that. But I kind of learned to go with that. I think that was an easier adjustment for me, I would say. And in fact, on moving back to North America, I sort of found the rigidity here a bit off-putting at first. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's something I can, that last point is something I can definitely relate to as well. It's definitely predictable and repeatable here, isn't it?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, so Linda, so before you went to India, were you staying home with your kids or were you employed immediately before the arrival?
No, yeah, well, our kids were pretty young, so I had been staying at home at that time.
Yeah. So I'm not sure how to ask it in a politically sensitive way, but just forgive me if it's the wrong way of saying it. So as a housewife or as a stay-at-home mom, how was that transition? Because that was one that was one that I saw my wife go through. And in a lot of ways, there are some nice surprises in India for a stay-at-home mom. Can you talk a little bit about what it was like running a home in India versus running a home in Seattle?
Well, again, it was this idea of having people around all the time. It was something that my husband had suggested when we moved there. He said, well, you know, one way that you can help people out here is by offering them a job in the house. So, you know, you can get a cook. Of course, that's affordable for an American living in India. You could get a maid. You could have a driver. So you, all of a sudden you become a household manager as a housewife there. And that was definitely an adjustment because of the cultural differences toward work and time that we just discussed. I found that challenging, but I kind of got into a groove with it after a while. I definitely never got used to not having my home to myself, that there were almost always people around. And that was, like I said, probably the hardest adjustment for me.
Yeah, yeah. So, Linda, India is described in many different ways. Obviously, the connection between the West and India is quite old, centuries old, and in a lot of ways romanticized. Day-to-day life in South Asia teaches that there's a bit of a gritty side to it as well, candidly. I think anyone listening would have some agreement with that statement. So what was hard about living in India? Something that you didn't expect that caused you some challenges, cognitively or otherwise?
I actually, I had traveled to India a few times before we had moved there and before we had children. And I guess in a way I was pleasantly surprised at how much easier it was than I expected it was going to be. I hadn't been to India since the late 1990s before we moved there. And at that time, it was still quite a nationalized economy. You didn't see many foreign goods. So I had fully prepared my kids for, you know, no more mac and cheese. It's going to be rice and dal every day. And, you know, forget about all the stuff you're used to seeing. So it was a shock to get there and see, oh, my kids were like, there's Pizza Hut and Baskin Robbins. So in that sense, I think for me, it was almost easier than I expected. And certainly the housing, there's a lot of American-style housing now that there didn't used to be. So I think I sort of came at it from another way, that living there in the late 2000 time was actually much easier than I thought. But certainly, you know, having to deal with power outages and maybe not having hot water all the time or those kind of things were challenging to deal with, for sure, but I guess not unexpected for me.
It's really interesting to me, Linda, your husband being from a Goan background and the Goan history in India is so rich and so interesting. Was there something in particular about your experience that was painted by the fact that your husband belonged to the Goan community, which is a small minority community, and there the population is concentrated in a certain part of India. Can you talk a little bit about that and your interaction with that community?
Well, I think my image of India was really framed very much by my husband's family. One of the things that I just assumed was that almost everyone in India spoke English, and that certainly wasn't the case in Hyderabad. So amongst, you know, my husband's family, actually they speak English together. That is really their first language, and they go to Catholic schools. I'm talking about the family that's in India. So I had assumed that was the case for most Indians, and of course that wasn't. And especially in Hyderabad, there's actually a lot of people who don't speak much English at all or any. So that was surprising. But in terms of Goan culture and how I've experienced it, really my strongest memories of it are from my time in Dubai when, as I said, I'd spend Christmas holidays with Goans. They have a very distinctive way of celebrating Christmas and lots of dancing, which was really fun. And while we were in India, we did, of course, go to Goa and visit family from my husband's side and other friends there. And just a very warm, fun place. I think Goans are really, well, they're known as the kind of the party people of India. And it's always about having a good time and eating great food and drinking beer and dancing and having fun. So I loved all of that. Of course, it's pretty, who wouldn't, right? It's hard not to love that.
Yeah, so quick tidbit here. There's a recent Bollywood movie called Ek Mein Aur Ek Tu with Kareena Kapoor and Imran Khan. And Kareena Kapoor plays a young the part of a young lady from the Goan community. And definitely there are scenes in the movie where she goes back to India and she's partying with her family. And it's very much a very open family culture. And they have a Goan-themed song in there. And then, of course, who can forget the classic movie Bobby from Bollywood, where I think it was one of the first major roles where the heroine, who is Dimple Kapadia, played a young girl from a Goan family who was fell in love with somebody from an elite Indian family. And, of course, from a musical perspective in South Asia, I can, you know, being from Pakistan, I can honestly say that the whole pop culture, pop music culture, and the good music that's coming out of Pakistan today would not be possible without the contribution of the Goan community, who since the 1960s came up with bands and promoted rock music in this,
right.
The whole subcontinent, actually.
Yes,
it's
yeah,
a great
it's
contribution.
My husband's family is not particularly musical, but his uncle, who lives in Mumbai, is quite an artist. He's a photographer and does incredible work and very provocative work, and I think it's very much a reflection of that open, artistic Goan culture.
Yeah.
Hey, Linda, is his name David D'Souza as well, the guy you just
Yes,
mentioned?
It is. Yes.
Yeah, you gave us a book that he took of, it's one of our coffee table books of pictures from around India. It was fantastic. We were looking at it recently, actually. We should put a plug in for him. What's the name of some of David's work?
Well, he's got a website, and I believe it is David D'Souza, D-E-S-O-U-Z-A, maybe .com. So,
okay.
Yes, he's very talented and does really some very interesting things.
That's
fantastic.
Awesome. And so, Linda, you found a particularly interesting and constructive way of immersion into the Indian culture where you found yourself, and it was through this creation of the nonprofit, which is, I think, a very interesting story. So can you just tell us a little bit about how that came about? And
sure. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I was there and, of course, had this household staff, as we talked about, who were cooking food for me and cleaning the house for me, and my kids were all in school. And so I thought, gosh, what am I going to do while I'm here for 2 years? And so, like a lot of the other expatriate people living in Hyderabad, I wanted to find out about volunteer opportunities. And so I got a chance through the Twin Cities Expatriate Association to volunteer at a local women's organization. And that was where my interest was and my background. So I set off to volunteer with Hadassah Women's Association, which is it was just a local, very small, grassroots nonprofit based in Hyderabad. And it was run by this very dynamic woman, Grace Rajkumar. And she welcomed me with open arms, and I went and helped her with her work as best I could. And I got to know her, and she's such an incredible personality. She's very vivacious and warm and welcoming, but also very strong-willed and willing to do a lot of really important work in working with women who are abused and exploited. And so she'd been doing this work for some time, helping women from abusive situations better their lives, and she offered legal assistance and job training for them and microloans, that kind of thing. But her big dream was to open a school for poor girls. I think she'd worked with enough women who had been abused and exploited that she really wanted to do something preventative. And for her, that meant opening a school. And I was just so impressed with Grace and all that she was doing. So I spoke to my husband and I said, "What do you think? Do you think we could help financially to get this school up and running?" And so my husband Dave agreed, and we set about helping Grace open her school. So Grace had a very specific vision. I think that's what impressed me as well. She really knew what needed to be done in her community, and she knew how she wanted to do it. She had picked a village just outside, within the city limits, but just outside Hyderabad. And it was very well connected with public bus routes to other villages. And so it was a good sort of nexus point, and that's where she wanted to locate the school. And she had a whole means of spreading the word about the school and how she would staff the school and so forth. So we found a building that we could rent, and it was in kind of dire shape, but we had some more toilets installed, and we painted it pink, and then set about recruiting students. And as I said, Grace had a very clear idea of how to do that, and her husband was a head teacher at one of the big private schools in Hyderabad, and he was getting ready to retire, so he came on board as the principal, and staff was hired. And now the school has over 150 girls. They're all from the poorest families in the area, and they receive a free, high-quality education as well as a nutritious breakfast and lunch. The big transformative thing about the school's name is Wings. The website is wingsschool.org. Wings is offering these girls the CBSE curriculum, which is a very high-standard curriculum in India. It's a national curriculum, and it's what a lot of the private schools in the country teach. It's normally not very available to the average person because of that. The state schools don't teach this curriculum. They teach a state curriculum, and often that curriculum is of a much lower standard, and it also doesn't teach English. The CBSE curriculum is an English medium curriculum. The girls also study Telugu, the local language, and Hindi, the national language. But the other subjects are all in English. And that's really significant because if they graduate from the school with the CBSE standard, they are really going to be in a great position to get scholarships at local universities. And they're also, with their level of English, going to be able to write the Indian Civil Service exams. These exams are what everybody aspires to in India. Working for the civil service is seen as, you know, a wonderful step up for your family. You get excellent benefits and a job for life. But the exams for those civil service jobs are in English. So if you've studied at a state school and have never learned English, you have no hope of ever passing those exams. So these girls will be in a very good position. She's also, Grace is also offering the girls job training as they start to get older. She'll be teaching them how to run their own small business. Some of them will be learning to be Hindi pundits, for example, as well, so that once they graduate, if they aren't able to go on to higher education, they'll be able to support themselves. So I'm just very pleased with the way the school is going. It's now just finishing its third year, and I really think it's going to be changing lives.
That's fantastic. It's such an amazing story. I'm just curious, can you tell us a little bit about the barriers that some of these girls face? Because we know about the poverty. Yes, that is a major barrier. But other than that, what are some of the stigmas, some of the prejudices, some of the mindsets that that surface as challenges in the work that you do?
Well, you know, it's the UN just came out with a report recently that stated that India is the deadliest place in the world to be a girl, in the world. And that's a sad fact, but the fact is that, first of all, millions of girls aren't being born every year. As you know, there's gender-selective abortion that happens, and so now there's this huge gender disparity, especially in northern India, where there's millions more young men than there are women. And these are men who are never going to find a wife because there are no women, right? There just aren't enough. And so what's happening now in India is that you have women or young girls who are being kidnapped, for example, to be sold into marriage into some families. In some cases, they are married into a family and expected to be the wife for several brothers. You also have an explosion of prostitution in these areas, which is really tragic because you have all these millions of men who have, as I said, no chance of finding a wife. So girls are now being kidnapped and taken into brothels in cities like Delhi and Calcutta. And of course, you know, with AIDS, it's just a tragic story. It's something that is really truly a tragedy that's happening now in India. So you have this problem of girls being exploited. And then you also have the problem that for poor families, girls are really seen as a financial burden. And it's because of the dowry system that once a girl is born, the parents are expected to save money to pay for a dowry once she is married. And then once she's married, she goes off and lives with her in-laws. She doesn't stay with her parents and help them. So girls are really seen as a liability, and this is why girls aren't being born in the first place, and then if they are born, they aren't being given the same opportunities as their brothers. And what happens is amongst the poorer classes in India, girls are often fed less than their brothers. They are often not taken to the hospital if they're sick, unlike their brothers. And when it comes to education, if they do get to go to school, they're often sent to the state schools. If the parents have any kind of money to scrape together for private education, it's the son who gets to go. So girls are just at a huge disadvantage. Girls from poor families are at such a huge disadvantage in India. And oftentimes they don't get the opportunity, even if they're at state schools, to finish schooling. You know, they'll be forced by their parents to go work as domestics in local houses, for example, and that's just a situation that's ripe for exploitation as well. Or, as I said, they're sold to go, you know, maybe the parents think the daughter's being sent to go work as a domestic or being offered a job somewhere, but in fact she ends up being forced into prostitution. Human trafficking now is at epidemic proportions in India. So, you know, huge barriers for these girls. And that's why, you know, one of the reasons the school offers the girls meals, because the fact that the school itself doesn't charge fees is enticing to the parents. But the fact that the girls also get fed at the school is a huge incentive for the parents to keep their daughters in school.
So, Linda, The Kiran Anjali Project, I'm looking at the website, mm-hmm. it's kaproject.org. How do you reconcile that against the picture of India rising, prosperity, a middle class of 300 million people? That's generally the story that's most prominent about India. And so can you talk a little bit about that reconciliation?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it is fantastic what's happened in India. It's really been an explosion of growth and opportunity, and it's wonderful to see that the middle class really is rising. I think, though, at the other end, you know, the poorer classes, that it's really still very much a struggle. I mean, there isn't famine like there used to be in India, you know, 60, 70 years ago. People do get fed. But it's a real struggle for those people at the fringe of society, and as I said, most especially for girls. So I mean, every nation deals with these kind of issues, and you know, we certainly have them here in the U.S. as well. But I think India, at least now, affords the opportunity. As I said, if you can find a way to lift people and give them the education, there is the opportunity for them to leap into this growing middle class. And that's really what we're hoping for these girls, you know, that they will graduate and they'll be in a position to either support themselves through work or go on to higher education. But either way, they'll have leaped into this growing middle class rather than being stuck in the underclass.
Linda, they're sobering statistics, right? And like you said, this should by no means be seen as something unique to India. I mean, I think throughout the world, the state of affairs for young women and girls is pretty tough. So it's all the more meaningful that that you're involved in this effort. Tell us a little bit about some of the successes you've seen. You went back after, you know, 2 years where the school was up and running. Can you talk about what you saw and what difference you're making?
Yeah, I definitely was overjoyed, actually, at how everything looked at the school and the girls. The girls are really amazing, and I invite anybody who's in the Hyderabad area who might want to go and visit the school to go take a look. They are so poised and well-spoken and eager in their studies. They are just very they're really taking advantage of this opportunity that they have, and it was just great to see. I feel great things are going to be coming out of that school for sure. The girls are still young now. The school started out with grades, basically kindergarten to grade 5. Now it's added a grade each year, so it's K to 7 right now. So they're still quite young. But as I said, I was just so impressed with how well-spoken they were and eager to learn, very interested in everything. So great to see.
Fantastic. So, Linda, if somebody wanted to make a difference through what you do and through the web, just to become more aware, perhaps to put resources into the school and make a difference in fostering, tell us a little bit about how someone could do that.
Well, once I got back to the U.S., I partnered with my friend Cheryl to start a U.S.-based 501c3 nonprofit called the Kiran Anjali Project. As you mentioned, the website is kaproject.org. And we really set this up as a means to offer advice and grants to women like Grace and others in India who are doing grassroots work and just need a little help. You know, I was so impressed during our time in Hyderabad and traveling throughout India at some of the great grassroots work that's being done to help this underclass, you know, move up. And Grace certainly wasn't the only person that I met. There's plenty of people out there doing great work, but they're doing it on a shoestring. They have so little in the way of resources. And so Kiran Anjali Project was really set up to offer professional advice to people like Grace who are doing this good work. And we really help, for example, source grants for them, international grants or U.S.-based grants. We teach them, you know, the kind of systems they have to have in place in order to be eligible for grants, help them apply, that kind of thing. We offer administrative advice, and then we also, as I said, offer grants. So So right now, the Wing School is our first project. And people who would like to help out and help us in what we're doing, you could go to our website, kaproject.org, make a donation if you'd like to make a donation, or simply just send me an email saying that you'd like to help out. And if you're interested in volunteering, we have things going on in the Seattle area and in the San Francisco Bay Area as well.
Well, hey, Linda, from my side, in terms of finishing up, I just want to say it's been fascinating to get your perspective on what it was like to live in India during the time that we mutually lived there. It brought back the memories, and that always makes me smile. But most especially, the good work that you're doing through the Kiran Anjali Project and the Wing School, and the focus on educating girls in a country that's increasingly able to educate them, and being a catalyst toward that happening is pretty inspirational. So from my side, thanks very much.
Well, thank you. And I think, I'm a big fan of Nicholas Kristof in the New York Times, and he and his wife, Sherry Wu Dunn, wrote a book called Half the Sky. And it's really a manifesto that talks about this pressing need to help the status of girls and women throughout the world. And the idea that there are people out there doing great work, they just need a little bit of help. They don't need to be told what to do. They know what to do within their own communities. They know what needs to happen. They just need a little extra help. And that's really what Kiran Anjali Project is all about. So thank you.
Thanks, Linda. I really enjoyed the conversation and the insight that you provided, which was the depth of it was way beyond what I had 40 minutes ago. So my appreciation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Linda.